Before I start today's message, I want to ask you what you know about two Bible characters, Adam and Noah. What do you know about them? Now, if you've been listening to all of our sermons here, then you should know a lot about Adam and Noah. We covered their sections in Genesis in depth years ago. But even if you've never been in a Christian church before and have never listened to a sermon before, if you live in the English-speaking world, you probably know who Adam and Noah are. In fact, you probably have an image of Adam standing in the Garden of Eden, wearing a fig leaf, and accepting a piece of fruit from a tree with a snake in it seared into your mind. Likewise, you probably immediately picture a long-bearded Noah standing on the deck of his giant ark filled with an assortment of animals. I would guess that any person who speaks English has some knowledge of these two characters. I bring that up because our next character of concern is someone whom most people who are not devout Christians have probably never heard of. His name is Balaam, son of Beor, and you might be surprised to find out that he receives attention in the scriptures which rivals the attention given to Adam or Noah. So, for example, Adam and Noah are both the central characters in five chapters here in the Torah. Well, Balaam doesn't get five whole chapters, but he does get three, those being Numbers, chapters 22 through 24, and he makes a brief reprise in chapter 31, arguably four chapters. Adam's name is mentioned 20 times in the Bible. Noah's name is mentioned 52 times. Balaam's name is mentioned 67 times. He's got them beaten there. And not only that, but Balaam appears more often outside the Torah than the other two do. Noah is only mentioned in four or five chapters outside the Torah, depending on how specific an author has to be. Adam is mentioned in six chapters outside the Torah, and Balaam ties him. And we should recall, Adam and Noah can both rightly claim to be the ancestors of every person living on Earth. They have a certain genealogical boost in those numbers. Balaam doesn't get those kinds of freebies. So when I mention Balaam, you might be thinking to yourself, Balaam? Who is he? Why should I care? But you should remember that the authors of the scriptures considered him to be quite important. They devoted a considerable amount of space to recording his story, and he clearly remained a relevant topic of discussion all the way through the New Testament era. So let's not discount him, or treat him lightly, or skip quickly past him. Let's pay attention to this fellow and figure out why the scriptures give him so much weight. Your passage for consideration is Numbers chapters 22 through 24, a long one. And if you haven't yet read it, I recommend that you pause and do so now. So before we dig into the specifics about this incident with Balaam, let's try to get an overview of who he was. Balaam, according to his own description in chapter 23, verse 6, was living among the Arameans. Chapter 22, verse 5 tells us that he was on the other side of the river, that being the Euphrates. So he was in the area of what is today Syria or Iraq. This is over 400 miles or 700 kilometers from Israel's current location. A fast-moving delegation, then, would have had to take a week or so to travel there on horseback. And Balaam engaged in the work of sorcery. He was the kind of person whose help would be sought in occultic spiritual matters, the type who would summon the dead or attempt to divine the future. If you wanted a hex placed on a person in the name of a god or of a demon, Balaam would be the man to call. Whether his work was ever actually successful, I suppose we don't know. What we do know is that he at least had a reputation for his work, which had spread across the Levant. Balaam was not a devout worshiper of Jehovah. He believed in the existence of Jehovah, but he kept him on an equal plane with other false gods, a violation of God's first commandment. And the worship of false gods wasn't Balaam's only sin. Balaam also worshipped those gods through the use of idols, prohibited by the second commandment, and he engaged in sexually immoral practices. Revelation 2, verse 14, ascribes both of these sins to Balaam, and the contexts provided in Numbers give witness to that. After the events of today's message, Balaam was involved in a certain incident at Peor, in which sexually immoral Moabite women led Israel into idolatry. We have that idolatry and sexual immorality recorded in Numbers 25, which we will not be discussing in this message. Look for more on that soon to come. But in that chapter, Balaam is not named directly. To see Balaam's connection with that, we have to leap ahead to Numbers 31:15 through 16. Therein, we read about the ultimate punishment for the women who followed Balaam's advice. Moses had his army kill them. Ultimately, Israelites killed Balaam as well. We find a record of that in Joshua 13:22, though the passage doesn't provide any details of exactly how that happened. So, now that we have a general idea of who Balaam is, and where he came from, and where he's going, let's get down to the episode in question, what he did in Numbers 22 through 24. First, we must set the historical stage. Israel just spent 40 years wandering the wilderness. They followed a serpentine route around the lands of Edom and Moab, and afterward conquered the lands of the Amorites east of the Jordan River, where they are now preparing to make a full-scale invasion of the Promised Land. Israel's aspirations are to the west, over the Jordan, where they intend to attack the Canaanites living there. However, as today's story opens, Balak, the king of Moab, to the south, is concerned by what he sees. We have established before that Moab had troubled relations with the Amorites, including the fact that war with the Amorites had seen some Moabites taken as slaves. Well, if the Amorites were a threat to Moab, Israel is much more so, because Israel just beat the Amorites badly in a short war in which none of the Amorites survived. King Balak's fear is truly heightened, because everyone in the region has heard the stories of how Israel's God led them out of Egypt and sustained them in the wilderness. Now King Balak's concern is misplaced. Israel isn't coming for him, and in fact, God had given Israel explicit orders to leave Moab alone. But King Balak evidently doesn't know that. So looking at the situation, he has a very reasonable concern. His concern is noted in chapter 22, verses 3 and 4, where Balak tells his elders that Israel will lick them up like an ox licks up grass. So the king is in a bad position. He believes that he is about to be attacked by a military force which his people cannot repel, and for this reason he seeks out the help of divine intervention. Just not the correct kind. Balak might have sought out the Israelite leadership and proposed a merger. Moab and Israel were distantly related, after all, and since Balak recognized the power of Jehovah, he might just as well have abandoned his false god Chemosh and converted his people to the Israelite religion. Instead, he decided to push back against Israel and to seek not the help of Jehovah, but the help of an idolatrous heathen sorcerer. And that, of course, is Balaam, our focal character. The king's objective is this: get Balaam to pronounce a curse on Israel, that is, to call down on them whatever horrors they supposed might be brought by the wrath of his imaginary gods. His hope was that if a spiritual man like Balaam would do this, then the gods would listen and Israel would be destroyed. He would soon learn, however, that the gods of Canaan and the Near East are no match for Jehovah, the one true God. So King Balak sent a delegation to summon Balaam, and when Balaam refused to go back with them, the king sent a second delegation to Balaam, which ultimately convinced him to return. When the first delegation arrived to meet Balaam, they went with money in hand to pay him for the work of delivering an effective curse, but Balaam asked them to stay the night so that he could inquire of Jehovah and make a decision. We should note that Balaam did not serve Jehovah exclusively, as we have described above. He was not one of God's covenant people, and because he lived quite openly in opposition to the first and second commandments, as well as others, we can also suppose that he was not a person with whom Jehovah was pleased. However, Jehovah was recognized as a deity by many in the Near East, so it is not surprising that Balaam would attempt to consult with him before cursing a people whom everyone knew he had previously helped. And so Balaam inquires of Jehovah, and in verses 9 through 12, Jehovah appears to him, evidently in a dream or a vision. And of course, God said, no. He told Balaam not to go curse Israel. The next morning, Balaam relayed the message and sent the delegation back home. Those princes, in turn, delivered the message to King Balak. Well, King Balak was not one to give up easily, and so he decided to wine and dine Balaam. He sent a more honorable delegation with more men in it. So Balaam is now receiving the top dignitaries of Moab and getting the real celebrity treatment. To make a comparison to modern times, at first he had just gotten a few lousy congressional aides, but now he's got the vice president sitting at his house. So we can imagine this large entourage of respected men appearing before Balaam with their fighting men armed as a security detail, and all of them setting up their tents like a small city, centered around Balaam. We can imagine at this point that he felt quite important indeed. But still he told them that he could not go with them. All the gifts of gold and silver and honor that he could receive would not outweigh the direct instructions given to him by God. Now, it isn't clear that Balaam is being genuine when he says this. Maybe he's just been holding out for the highest dollar, and giving himself the moral high ground to do so. If he was genuine, Balaam is to be commended for at least this one statement. He seems to recognize, at least at this point in the narrative, that the ultimate honor of having favor with God outweighs any favor or riches he could gain from men. He will not remain that way for long, however. He ultimately bent to their pressure and bid them to stay again for the night while he consulted Jehovah. And that, I think, shows the condition of Balaam's heart. God had already clearly told him no, but like an annoying child, Balaam now comes to ask again. Why? Because he wants the money, that's why. Balaam already knows that he ought not to curse Israel, but he's prepared to do so anyway, and thus he asks once more. And this time, God gives Balaam a different instruction. If, he says, the men have come to call you, rise and go with them. Now, some have placed a great deal of emphasis on that if. The reason the if is important in their minds is that they say a condition exists in which Balaam ought to go, that being if the men come to call him. The supposition then being that if the men arise in the morning and come back begging Balaam to follow them, he should follow. Otherwise, he should not. That understanding is unsatisfactory, however, because the Hebrew uses the perfect tense of the verb rendered to come. God did not say, if they come to call you, but if they have come to call you. And indeed, they had come to call him. So with this, greedy Balaam sees his opportunity to go and make a quick buck cursing Israel, and he leaps up to go. We must note, though, that God also instructed Balaam to do only what he was told, and my suspicion, which I believe is borne out by the context, shows that Balaam had it in mind to remain disobedient and to bring down a curse on Israel as he was being paid to do. So Balaam goes out riding on his donkey, and God is angry with this. Some have supposed there is a contradiction here, or that the passage demonstrates God to be fickle or dishonest. I think that problem is resolved readily enough, though. The scriptures inform us elsewhere that Balaam was very much interested in the financial gain. You'll see that later on. And so, I think it is more than reasonable to say that God was angry not so much because of the going itself, but because of the going in an attempt to disobediently curse Israel. For that offense, God decided to intervene. The result is one of the more peculiar stories of the Old Testament, that of Balaam's famous talking donkey. Balaam was riding on the way to Balak, when the angel of Jehovah, whom we have discussed elsewhere, see our message on July 17, 2016, blocked his way, standing with a drawn sword in hand. Evidently he was visible to the donkey, but not to Balaam. Why? My supposition is that he intended to demonstrate his supernatural power. The fact that the donkey could see him, but Balaam couldn't, proves that something otherworldly is going on, and the end result, a talking donkey, drives that point home. So the angel of Jehovah appears, the donkey turns aside off the road, Balaam is angry, so he strikes her. Then the angel appears again, this time in a place where she can't just wander off the road. She moves to the side to avoid him, and she crushes Balaam's foot in the process. Yet again, he strikes her. Finally, the angel of Jehovah blocks the path in a place where Balaam's donkey simply can't get past, so she lies down and refuses to carry Balaam further. This time, Balaam beats the donkey with his staff, which might be an indicator that he gave her a harder beating than he had previously. With that, the donkey has had enough, and she protests, verbally, demanding to know why Balaam keeps hitting her. From the donkey's perspective, it isn't her fault at all. There's a man with a sword standing in the way. Balaam seems to be unfazed by a talking donkey. I, for one, would have immediately abandoned my trip to curse Israel and started a traveling show charging people to see the talking donkey. But Balaam, instead, gives his explanation. The donkey is making a fool of him by refusing to obey his orders. We recall that Balaam has two servants with him, see verse 22, and aside from that, we expect that all of the dignitaries are still going ahead of him, so he has someone before whom he has to be embarrassed. We also note that this is a time when riding on a donkey was as common as riding in a car is today. Everyone could do this without any problem. And any person of renown would surely have access to a donkey which was better trained than to just run off the road over and over again. So let me try to put this in modern terms. Imagine that you're riding in a motorcade with the vice president at a moment which is supposed to be some great honor to you, but your car breaks down three times on the way. Well, a person who can't keep his car tuned up probably isn't the kind of person who belongs in a presidential motorcade. And you would probably feel pretty embarrassed if you were riding a broken-down old car in a line of distinguished people. And Balaam is embarrassed in a like manner. He's so embarrassed, in fact, that he is prepared to kill the donkey for the sake of defending his honor. And if he had a sword, he would have done it. But then the donkey gives a rhetorical question which shows some exceptional reasoning skills for a donkey. To paraphrase, "Haven't I been your donkey for all your life?" End of note, it would not be unheard of for a donkey to live 50 years. Well, yes, the donkey had been with Balaam a long time. Had she acted this way before? No. So if the donkey is acting strangely for the first time in decades, it goes to reason that some external stimulus has caused her to react. And it is this reasoning, as Peter put it, which restrained the prophet's madness. Suddenly Balaam's eyes were opened and he too could see the angel of Jehovah. And of course, he would have to know that this was a supernatural occurrence and not just some man with a sword. He had appeared from invisibility and quite clearly had given a donkey the gifts of both speech and Socratic rhetoric. And now the angel of Jehovah speaks. First, he asks, again rhetorically, why Balaam has been striking his donkey. He then points out that it is not the donkey, but the angel who opposes Balaam, and that Balaam deserves the opposition because of his conduct. The donkey, in fact, has saved Balaam, because if it had not avoided the angel of Jehovah, then the angel would have killed Balaam for his error and let the donkey live. At this, Balaam repents of his sin and offers to turn back. While the passage does not say so explicitly, we take it that Balaam had left his home with a wrong motivation, a motivation which, if he had been permitted to act on it, would have resulted in sin worthy of death. And now the angel of Jehovah has shown that he is serious about the matter. Balaam will deserve the penalty, and if he continues, it will be enforced. I wonder if perhaps Balaam had written off his previous visions of God as just some dream or some imagination of his mind. This is a man who is accustomed to receiving messages from gods who are no gods at all. But now he can't continue to deny the reality. Here is the angel in the road during waking hours. Balaam sees him, and the donkey sees him. Balaam has two servants with him, and they likely see him as well. And they're seeing his supernatural power in the speaking donkey. Perhaps most importantly, they see the sword already drawn, so they have to follow this to the natural conclusion. This is real, and Balaam really is going to die if he doesn't obey. On those grounds, his motivation has changed very quickly. Suddenly, he's not worried about the money anymore, and he has no plan to curse Israel. He's ready to take his orders and go back home. But the angel of Jehovah doesn't send Balaam back home. Instead, he sends him on to Balak, demanding that he speak only that which the angel of Jehovah tells him to say. So Balaam continues on his journey, and he meets King Balak at the border of Moab near the Arnon, close to the territory now occupied by Israel. Balak expressed his displeasure with Balaam, asking him why he had not appeared when King Balak first called for him. Balaam responds essentially with a "better late than never," and points out that it is not in his power to curse Israel unless God curses Israel. So the two traveled on together, with King Balak making some sacrifices of sheep and oxen, evidently in an attempt to draw Jehovah's favor so that he will curse Israel. And in the morning they finally arrive at their destination, Bamoth Baal, or as the King James has accurately translated it, the high places of Baal. We haven't talked much about Baal yet, but the simplest version is that Baal was a pagan god of the region. The word Baal translated to English means, ironically, lord or master. The same word is used throughout the Hebrew scriptures to refer to a master over a slave or even a husband over a wife. Often Baal is used to describe a pagan god known as Hadad, a god of sky and storms, who in later times would be equated with Zeus and Jupiter. But Baal doesn't refer only to this one specific god in the Old Testament, so much as the word is used to refer to a number of different pagan deities of the nations surrounding Israel. These fraudulent gods were often worshipped in high places where sacrifices were made. So this Bamoth Baal ought rightly to be understood as simply a high place where sacrifices were made to pagan gods. Recall also that Jehovah, while not worshipped exclusively, was recognized as a deity by more than just Israel. Particularly, we should recall that the Moabites came from a lineage close to that of Abraham, so it is likely that, in their mind, Jehovah was one of the Baals whom they served at this high place. Now, obviously, they had not received the revelations and the covenant that Israel had, and their worship was not acceptable because it was tainted by the worship of other gods, among other problems. But here's the point. They're at a high place where sacrifices are made, and looking out from that place, they can look north and see the camps of Israel. So Balaam directs King Balak to build 7 altars, and on each of them, he sacrifices a bull and a ram. This is apparently an imitation of Israel's worship. Balaam and King Balak know that Jehovah is supporting Israel, but they are attempting to draw Jehovah away from them and onto their own side. After the sacrifices have been made, Balaam goes up onto the height of the mountain, where God meets with him and gives him the words to say. Balaam then goes back down with the words. So King Balak has sought Jehovah's favor against Israel, and now Jehovah has given an answer. Balaam stands on the height and delivers the verdict, and it is not one which King Balak likes. The answer, to summarize, is this. Balak called me down here to curse Israel, but I can't do it because God won't do it. When he looks down on Israel, Balaam sees a unique people expanding to such a number that they are like dust, that is, uncountable. As for Balaam, he could only hope to be as good as Israel, living an upright life and dying a noble death. Obviously, Balak is none too pleased at this, and he says as much. That's no curse. Being enviable for your righteousness and having innumerable descendants are good things, not bad. And of course, Balaam responds as he has responded before. Don't blame the messenger. I'm only telling you what God tells me. Due to its great length, this message has been split in half for time's sake. You can listen to the continuation at eastjordan.church.